This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today, we will continue to read cowboy poetry, reminiscences, and short stories by Bruce Kiskaden. This book is entitled Shorty's Yarns, Western Stories and Poems of Bruce Kiskaden. It was written by B. Kiskaden, K. Field, and B. Seams, and published in 2004 in Logan, Utah, by Utah State University Press. I remind you before we begin that we occasionally edit our stories for recording. We'll start with a poem entitled Riding School. I've heard 'em say, in riding schools, they got a regular book of rules. The man that wrote the book explains the way to set and hold your reins. And other lessons facts reveals about your elbows and your heels. You read, you practice, and then decide if you've really learnt to ride. A cowman doesn't give a care about how you ride, just so you're there, nor how you hold your hands and feet. The main thing is to hold your seat. You learn more from a bucking hoss than any school you come across. For you and him can soon decide what's underneath each other's hide. I got a real chuckle out of that poem. What riding I know how to do, I learned in Colorado on a Western saddle, and most of riding then was getting from point A to point B successfully on your horse, without any regard for where you held what. On the other hand, my older daughter for many years rode English, and I watched her spend hours and hours and hours trying to make sure her hands were in the right place, her posture was correct, her heels were in her stirrups correctly, etc., etc., etc. Just between you and me, I think I had more fun. We're going to continue reading from Chapter 6 now, which is entitled Shorty and the Professors. Our first story is entitled Shorty Rescues the Second Professor. After Zeb gets spilled off'n his horse, he's poking around for a few days on account he's so sore and stove up he can't hardly travel. He gets some of the liniment that Bill has got off'n the medicine man and is rubbing it all over hisself. He says that he found it under the eaves of the bunkhouse in a space between the rafters. He allows it's mighty good stuff. But the professor, he gets a lot of fixings out of his trunk. He takes a bottle of the liniment to the kitchen and works for quite a spell. And when he gets done, he tells us that this here liniment is a fake and ain't up to much. Zeb, he allows it's good stuff and is a-helping him, whatever it is. So they have a argument, which ain't no help, seeing Zeb and the professor ain't none too friendly, no way. The day following, I goes up to the mountain pasture to get some saddle and work hosses, and I takes the professor along, hoping it will keep him and Zeb sorter separated till things blows over. There's been a big rain up above, and when we get to Brushy Creek, it is up bad. I tells him we had better wait till the creek runs down, which won't be over a couple hours at most. He laughs at me and wants to know what I'm scared of. He says that this here little creek ain't over 50 foot wide right now, and that a feller can jump across it most times. I allows him that pint, but I tells him that a man is crazy to ride such water. Well, then he told me that he has swum as much as 3 mile at a time in the ocean, and that I'm trying to pick a load onto him. It wasn't no use to argue with him, so I just gets off and loosens my cinch to let my horse rest till the water run down. Likewise, the professor. I hears him start and looks, and he is riding right in. I yells at him, but it ain't no use. Boy, howdy. Old Chunky rolled plumb over, but he got his front feet on the bank and scrambled out. A rope ain't no use in that brush water. So I runs to where the current swirls in again the bank and grabs the stout brush to keep me from being pulled in. The professor is rolling like a tumbleweed, only he's out of sight most of the time. But luck is with us, and just as he washes in again the bank, he happens to come up wrong end too. But them puffy riding pants is what saves him. I grabs him by the seat of the britches. All of the pants that he wasn't occupying was full of water, and they sure did go squirsh when I takes a holt. But they was made of good stuff, and stands the drag till I gets him swung around where I land him. He is a game old cuss, for all through that rolling around he ain't strangled, on account of he knows enough to hold his breath while his head's under water, and to grab a breath whenever his head comes up. But he sure has been rolled and pounded around and lost his specs. He rests, and the sun and the wind dries his clothes, and when the creek runs down, he helps me get the hosses and take them back to the ranch. He offers me a good day's pay to ride to town and send a telegram to his hometown for a new pair of specs. He claims that his specs was made to measure, same as you'd send off and get a pair of boots, and this here place where he's sending has his eye measure. And taking it all through, it does sound mighty sensible, so I does what he wants. Now, it is early in the evening when I get back from town next day. But F, he's hanging around the corrals, and he is uneasy, says the cook wanted him to keep close by, for Zeb and the professor has been jawing at one another considerable. Now that Zeb, he is a nasty fighter. He is big and stout, and he can wrestle, and he kicks and he butts. Besides, he ain't above chawing on a feller if the going gets too tough. Things was all right till we was at the wash bench and washing up for supper, and the professor was a-talking to me about the crick and what happened up there. Zeb, he horns in. "You school people is all alike," he says. "All you do is go around and get into trouble, depend on somebody to help you out. All you got to do is shut your mouth and keep out in them kinds of places. Y'all talk about science. When a feller says he is scientific, it just means he's crazy." "Who called on you to preach a sermon?" the professor asks. "Who's going to stop me?" Zeb asks. The professor grins right nasty. "Oh, maybe a woman, maybe a horse, maybe even a dog," he says. Zeb makes a dive for underholts, but he misses and rolls on the ground, for the professor can sure sidestep. He makes another dive, but he misses and gets a kick as he went by that sure did knock the dust out in his pants. He sees that his man ain't so easy, so he straightens up and comes in a swinging for the professor right and left. But somehow, the professor keeps away from them licks, and all the time he is shooting in quick straight punches that is sure putting a face on Zeb. Zeb sees that he is licked if he don't go to the ground with him, and he makes another dive for the underholts and lays hisself open for a right to the jaw. He goes down, but gets up and goes at it. It ain't no use, for he is jarred and dizzy, and the old professor walks around him like he's tied and pours it to him. Then he gets a chance and lets poor Zeb have it for a knockout. What surprised me the most was that when Zeb got his bearings and knowed where he was at, he ups and shakes hands with the professor. "That was what you might call a little science," says the professor. "I reckon as how it was," says Zeb. Now we will read. The professor buys a horse and a dog. In a week or two, Zeb and the professor has got over their ruckus, and they is both pirootin' around looking for more trouble of some kind, only they don't know they're running their snouts into trouble. They just run into it, sorter dumb-like. I sure wished what Bill was back, for when Bill started something, the whole world and Bill hisself knowed what was a-going on, but these here Jaspers was plumb a-past me. One morning, the professor says that he is going over to Lem Sykes' place. When he is about to start, F hollers to him and says, "Say, Prof, don't leave nothing at Lem's place. Don't bring nothing back from there, for if you do every one, you'll sure be sorry." You see, Lem is one of them fellers that has a team and a wagon and a lot of trading stuff. The more he trades, the more stuff he gets. The more of that kind of stuff he gets, the poorer he is. He has a few scrubby cows and hosses, and some bean ground, and a little patch of alfalfa. He likewise has a wife, and a whole lot of kids, not to speak of a whole passel of dogs. But the principal thing he has is time. Next day, old Chunky, the horse he rode, comes into the corral without no saddle nor bridle on, and we know that he has been turned loose, or else he's got away from the professor. We was worried some, but long about sundown, here comes the professor, a-riding a old pacing mare that is most as old as him. He has a snaffle bit on her, and he's leaning back and plow-lining her around, and his head is reared back like a coffee-pot lid. But worst of all, he's leading an old pot-hound alongside, just as solemn as you please. "Oh, Lord," says Zeb, "where is Uncle Tom and little Eva at?" "Don't rib him none," I says, "and let me find out what Lem Sykes has done to this here man of education." After supper, I gets a talk with him and asks him about the old mare. He ruffles right up and says, "You see, Shorty, these western horses are all treacherous and vicious. They are abrupt in their movements and tender mouthed. This animal I purchased is of the best blood and easy gaited and gentle. I got a different bit, too, so she will not become used to this miserable style of loose-reined riding like the horses in this country." "Man," I says, "that old mare is a stargazer that don't look where she's a-going, and she turns about as quick as a team in a wagon." "Well," he says, nasty-like, "if a man knows where he is going, he should at least be able to direct his horse. And as far as turning quick, that is a minor affair. The average cowpuncher works for $35 or $40 a month and is on call 24 hours a day. So if you figure it down fine, his time is so valuable that if he is real quick, he might save about 2 cents worth of time on 500 turns." That sure made me wish he hadn't licked Zeb, but I held on to my temper and says, "And that there hound dog?" "That dog," he says, "is a trailer. I got him to hunt coyotes with. He will follow the track of one till he tires him out, and I have a small pistol with which to shoot him when I overtake him." "That hound, you mean?" I asks. "The coyote," he yells, "and I knows I got him on that one." "What's Lem done with all the coyotes this here dog has catched, I want to know?" But he bows up and quits me. We had to keep the hound in the chicken corral, or else Shep and Shag would have took him apart and seen what made him go. One morning, right soon, we heard the old hound bellerin' and looked out. And there he was a-going at a trot out across the flat, and the professor was side-wheeling along behind on the old mare, and she seemed to be looking for the morning star. I slaps a saddle onto the first hoss I can grab, and I takes out after him. I don't get there soon enough, for when I'm about 50 yards away, the old mare steps right into a dog hole, and down she goes. She can't even fall down quick, but upsots sorter like a load of hay, and the professor is slower yet and lets her lay down on his leg. I was going to jump onto her head and uncinch the saddle, but that ain't needed. She laid right still, and after we'd loosened the saddle, we had a job to make her get up. She seemed to think it was right comfortable where she was at. The professor, well, he was on a cane for a few days, and when the hound comes back, we puts him back in the chicken corral. The professor takes and lets him out for a spell every evening for exercise, he says. One evening, we was just a-going in for supper, when we hears the old hound start bellering, and he sure can beller. He's making for a shed a little ways from the house, and we all wondered what he was after. but we didn't have to wait long. He was trailing old Topsy, the black cat, and she has a nest of kittens in that shed. He don't have no trouble catching up to Topsy. She's right out to meet him, and jumps right up on the middle of his back and starts to work with her teeth and all 4 feet. That old hound lets out awful yells and takes out. Topsy's got a good hold, and she's riding him out across the pasture and making the fur fly ever jump. She stays for about 200 yards, and then she jumps off. All that worries her is the fact she has to walk back. When the hound gets his bearings, he makes out for Lem Sykes' place in a long lope. "Well," says Zeb, "Lem's going to be one dog poorer again." Says Eph, "He'll feel a heap more contented there where there ain't nobody nor nothing got ambition enough to bother him none." We all sat still for a spell after supper that night, for it was sort of pretty outside, with the stars beginning to show. Then a bad thing happens. Old Toad hops out in front of the porch. Eph jumps up and catches him and says to the professor, "Here, professor, you take this here varmint, train him a little. You might get him to catch that old eagle for ye that lights up on the butte sometimes." The professor gives him a nasty look and says, "I see I will have to give another yokel a lesson about minding his own business." "That is if you can," says Eph, right pleasant. The professor limps into the house and we goes to the bunkhouse. "Eph," I says, "I'm betting you $1 to a donut you'll have that there professor to lick as soon as his leg gets well. And I'm betting you a new pair of boots, again a Stetson hat, that I'd do it, too," Eph says. I holds out my hand, and we shakes. "That's a bet," says Eph. Our next story is entitled, "Eph and the Professor Says Goodbye." When I gets back from the next work, I sees Rildy Briggs' saddle laying in the corral, and I knows that trouble is right close by. Eph and Zeb gives me a big hello, like them two boys always did, and helps me unsaddle and unpack and drag my bed into the bunkhouse. The cook, he gets me to one side and tells me that there is some sort of deal on, only he don't know what it is, and the professor is acting plumb loco. He's seen him fight in the air like a boxer when there wasn't nobody near him, and he has a jumping rope hit out, and when he thinks nobody's looking, he skips the rope just like some school gal. Well, I tells the cook that's the way that professional fighters train, and the professor is likely getting ready to give Eph a licking for the talk he made about the toad. "He'll never do it," says the cook. "He licked Zeb," I says, "and Zeb is a heap bigger and stouter than Eph. Besides, he's trained." The cook says, "I didn't see old Topsy skipping any ropes nor pawing the air before she cleaned up on that hound dog. She was just naturally a rough scrapper. So's Eph. There won't be no time for boxing and tromping around if he ever goes in. He's a plumb cross between a wildcat and a bulldog. I've seed his kind before." When we gets to the table, the professor don't talk to nobody, but sets up straight and proud-like. Realty, she talks a-plenty. She says that about 3 weeks ago, some folks come a-past their place in a covered wagon, and Lem Sykes' old pot-hound was a-follerin'. They told her that he come into camp the night before, all clawed up, and they kept him. They named him Scratch, on account he had cat tracks all over him. They said he looked like a good possum dog, so they aim to take him back to Missouri. We all gets a big laugh. Zeb allows he might be all right for possums, but he sure ain't no good for cats. The professor has been looking mighty frosty, but now he looks so red and hot that he could thaw a tolerable good-sized iceberg. After supper, Rildy saddles up and starts home. She says her brother will meet her on the way. I saddles up and goes along till she meets the brother. As soon as we're on the way, she tells me that her and Eph and Zeb and her uncle has got up an irrigation company. Seems like she'd watched the professors a little, and they was planning a scheme. They'd found out that sugar beets would grow on this ground, so they was looking things over. But her and Zeb and Eph and her uncle has took up dry claims all over the ground they was looking at, and they've even staked one out for me to file on. Her uncle being a mining man, he knowed how to form a company, and so they did, and took out their water rights in Brushy Creek and Sand Creek. It don't take but short ditches and small dams to turn them two creeks out onto the flats, and their places is right below Clay Flat, and they aim to make a big reservoir there because that ground holds water like a bottle. Old McDougal, the attorney, he's a-handling the law part of it for them, and the boss is all bowed up seeing him and the professors aim to make a real estate affair out of it. But the boss was careless and slow about getting started, so they beat him to it. That was as far as she got, because we met her brother, and she went on home, and I went back to the ranch. Next day the professor talks to me, and I'm plumb surprised. He tells me that him and the boss was aiming to get hold of a big piece of land and put water on it, and that he had depended on the boss to get folks to file on the land and to take out the water rights, whilst he is interested in some capital in the scheme, and they allowed to make a good piece of money out of it. But the boss is fooled around, and before he knowed it, them hay shakers has beat him to it. The professor is as mad at the boss as he is at the others, and says he's all fed up, he's going home in a day or two. He seemed sort of friendly to me, and allowed that we'd all us got along. That night, Ridley's uncle comes in with a lot of papers and things, and he does a lot of talking, and the professor is so mad that he walks out and don't care to listen. Old uncle hollers after him, "Hey you, come back here, you might learn something." Well, in the next few minutes, we all learn something. The professor walks back, punches uncle 3 times in the face, and clouts his jaw so sudden that the old feller has 2 black eyes and is knocked out before he knows it. F, he gets white and begins to shake all over and starts toward the professor. The professor comes at him just like he done for Zeb, but it ain't no use. F flies at him like a wildcat and grabs him so he can't box. He can wrestle, but that ain't no use either. F is like a wild man. He can take a lick that would stop a common man, and he's fighting with his feet, his knees, and his elbows, and button too, when he gets a chance. The old house shakes till the wall lamp dances up and down on its nail, and they send table and chairs and everything a-flying, for they are rolling around like a pair of tomcats, and you can't tell which is which for a minute. And then F plants himself on top and gives him the cyclone finish. The business talk is over. Uncle leaks out for home, and the rest of us turns in for the night. Next day, I helps the professor pack and takes a team and a wagon and hauls him to town. As we're starting, Zeb comes over to the wagon and says to me, "F says tell you he wears a No. 7 hat. The professor asks what he means by that, and I tells him about the bet. When we get to town, he gets his ticket, checks his baggage, and then he takes me and gets me the best pair of boots that we can find, ready-made. I sure have to thank him. He don't seem to care that he's got a black eye, one ear sticks out from his swelled-up jaw like he had the mumps. We don't see the boss, and I don't want to, but just as the train is ready to pull out, here he comes. He's been a-drinking and is all bowed up. He starts right in to give the professor a cussing out, and the professor tells him that he ain't nothing but a big, dumb mossback. The boss, he turns purple, and his big mustache bristles like a bobcat's whiskers. He tells the professor that he ain't nothing but a he-schoolmarm and ain't fit for to be noticed by a man. The boss's big stomach is sticking out, tempting-like, and the professor socks a punch into the pit of that stomach that knocks the wind plumb out of the old man, and then he starts working on his face and jaw, so it is surprising. The boss, he tries to fight and flails and stumbles around, but he can't land nary a lick. Pretty soon the professor gives him one in the jaw, and he sits down on the platform so hard that his pants splits and some of the buttons pops off in his vest, which ain't surprising, seeing he is so big and fat, and that he is a considerable strain on his clothes anyhow. The professor gets on the train, and they're just pulling out. He hollers, "So long, shorty," and waves to me. I waves back. Then I look at the boss. He sure looks like a wreck sitting there with his nose a-bleeding, and one eye shut, and his watch chain busted. I don't wait for nothing, but I get to the stable and hitch up that there team and pound him on the tail with the line. Our next story is entitled, Shorty Turns Diplomat. Well, me and the cook goes out to look at them claims, and then he gets a hoss and pokes around for a day or two. When I goes in to file, so does he. I have a good claim, but what do you reckon? He takes a claim right in the middle of Clay Flat, where they aim to have the reservoir. Nobody hadn't thought of that till plumb now. It might make a difference in how they handle the ditch stock, he says. I was just getting fixed to make a trip into the lower country, when one evening, just about sundown, in drives the boss with his little team and buckboard. He has an old traveling bag in the back, and he's wearing his high-heeled boots. He climbs out of the buckboard, slow and careful-like, and holds to the wheel. He gets his bearings, takes the traveling bag out, but then he loses his balance and sets on the ground. He looks all around, but I know he can't see very fur, so I just watch the show. He gets to the yard gate with the old traveling bag bumping against his legs. I put the team away, and then I go in to see him. He was a-settin' there trying to light a cigar. First he got the match away out in front of it, then he was trying to get a fire started in the middle of it. Finally, he gets it going and he says, Shorty, things has come to a terrible pass. Them fellers wasn't no professors than I am, and that their little irrigation scheme was all a blind, because they tried to get some of us ranchers to sink some money into it, but what they was a-laying for was to put over a big mining swindle. They was all fixed up to do it, for they've got away with it a couple of times before. How they keep out of the pen beats me. They ain't nothing but a bunch of high-class swindlers. All they got for me was a little time and grub, but they got a few friends of mine for some before I got wise to them, and that makes hard feelings between them and me. I tells him what the cook has done, and maybe we can rig it up for a good place to raise feed and winter stock on them claims, and it might turn out good after all. But that ain't the worst part of it, he says. It's the town and the wife. I sure been living an awful life. All she does is go to a lot of little doings that ain't fitting for a 7-year-old kid, if the kid's got any sense. She goes to some other woman's house, or has a lot of women come to our house. They set, they play a half-cocked game. When they get through, they have some weak tea or chocolate, little bitty cups that don't hold a good swaller, and eat some sandwiches that it would take 3 of them to make a bite. I can't fit in around no such doings as that. But what makes it worse, yet, if I go down to Johnny's place and play poker, she howls on account of the smell of liquor and tobacco smoke. If I go to the livery barn and talk for a spell with the boys, she says I smell like a hoss. All that women up in town do is go around with their nose stuck in the air, a-trying to smell something they don't like. Why, she's lost 10 pounds, and she's gotten so fur along in sassity that she's beginning to want a surgical operation. I looks at the old man for a spell, and I says, don't you reckon there might be some sort of ID that would work? I ain't got no more IDs, he says. I come back to the old ranch to stay. Do you reckon, I says, that she might come back here and be like she used to? That's too much to hope for, he says. Next day, I make an excuse that I needed a few things before leaving for the lower country, and the boss lets me take the buckboard and go to town. When I gets there, I don't go to the livery stable, but I goes and puts the team in the stable at the house where the boss lived. The missus is there, and she comes out right now, begins to talk, and I can see that the boss is right. She's lost a lot of weight, and she ain't spry and sassy like she used to be. Well, I says, we sure miss you a heap, but it's going to be good to have the old boss around once more. That's why I come up, to get his slippers. It'll look a heap more home-like with him there. First, there won't be no women folks, but it'll be better than it was. And then I sort of stops and studies a minute, till I can see that she's all ears, thinking I got something worthwhile to say. And then I says I reckon that if Zeb and Rildy gets married, they might manage to move in, and that'd be a heap better. She'd make the place more womanish and homelike. Then I goes downtown for a couple of hours. When I comes to the door for the boss's slippers, she is sure up and a-coming. She's packed two suitcases and is all ready to drag it for the ranch. The boss is surprised all right, but he can't figure it out. There's a dance at the schoolhouse the following night. She goes, and she's as tickled and lively as a school gal. How she does watch Zeb and Rildy. Next morning, I am packed and saddled to start to the lower country. She gets a chance and she says to me, Shorty, who told you Zeb and Rildy was going to get married? Well, nobody in particular, as I recollect, I says. But what give you the idea they might? She says. I don't see that they take much notice of one another. I reckon you're right, I says. Well, then why did you talk about them getting married and her moving into my house? She wants to know. Well, I says, I don't reckon they would, but if they did, that their plan was possible. Anything can happen, and if you was here like you used to be, why they'd never think of it. Now, I gotta be a-goin', I says. She blushes like a kid and looks at me, and she asks, Did you miss me that much? We sure did, every one of us, even to Shep and Shag, I says. Shorty, she says, you're a diplomat. I reckon I am, I says. I don't blame you for calling me anything at all. It was a mean, sneaky way to do, but if it only worked, I'll be even lower down than a diplomat, whatever that is, and I'll care not a cuss neither. She laughs and says, It worked all right, Shorty, and when I called you a diplomat, I didn't mean to take it back. So I leaks out for the lower country, but I knowed one thing. I'm going right close to Wilson's place, and old Miss Wilson used to be a schoolmarm. Name to stop there and find out just what they mean when they call a feller a diplomat. Now we will read Shorty's Boss Buys a Mule Team. Well, things got sorter settled down, and the boss and all the old folks that has took up claims has gone in partners and is going to make a real feed and pasture place out of the deal. That is, all except Rildy and her uncle. We don't look for no more trouble till Bill comes back from the war. Then all at once the boss rides in leading a span of mules. We all goes to look at him, and the missus wants to know where he got him. I got him off Lem Sykes, he says. Lem got him from some folks in a covered wagon, and he's had Bill a sale and give one, so I reckon it's all right. They're young, and when they get fat, I reckon they'll make a good team. We need 'em, but the old team is getting a lot of age on 'em, and these here is good for a long time. The wife, she looks at the mules and says, Good for a long time? Them mules won't never be good no time. Get 'em fat, and they'll pay you back by keeping somebody crippled up and a lot of stuff broke as long as you got 'em. You said yourself that nothing never good ever come from Lem's place. And now you gone and done it. What did you go near there for, anyhow? Did you pay him cash yet? The boss looks down his nose and says, I'll give him a check. Send Shorty to town right now with a letter and stop that check and let Zeb take the mules back, she says. No, dear, I don't do business that way, he says. Put the mules in the back shed, Shorty. Turn them out on the range and set Shep and Shag on them, she says. Yes, I know what you think. You wish a lot of times I'd stayed up in town and minded my own business. Well, I didn't, and I ain't a-going to. Now, dear, everything's going to be all right. Don't go and get so fussed up, he says. Next day, the boss allows F can hitch up the new mules and fetch some wood down from the hills. So F, he harnesses them up, puts them to the wagon. Him being a Missourian, he's fond of mules, and he's right pleased. I'm all saddled up to go, so opens the gate for him, and he gets up on the seat and starts. When he does, them mules looks back, and then away they goes. F, he's a-pullin' for all he cost, but all he can do is to clear the gate posts, and away he goes out there through the pasture, just a-foggin'. They take up the road along the fence. I bounce my hoss and takes after the mules, a-buildin' a loop in my rope. But before I can get to them, they hubs a post, throws Eb and the wagon box into the barbed wire fence. They busts the reach out of the wagon, circles back, and fetches up again the corral fence, where Zeb and the boss gets him. I get F untangled right soon, and he's cut up sorter bad in the wire. Boss keeps a-looking toward the house uneasy-like, and sure as the good Lord made little green apples, here she comes. She helps us get F into the bunkhouse and to doctor him up with some of the medicine Bill still had left from the show. Then she looks at the boss right happy and says, Don't you go and worry, dear. Everything is going to be all right. Them mules was used to working with blinkers on, I says, and it was them open bridles made the trouble. She just keeps a-laughing and says, Oh, yes, you must work mules with closed bridles. Yeah, and they ought to work women folks with closed mouths, says the boss. The following afternoon, the boss and Zeb hitches up the new mules to the spring wagon, puts on some posts and wire, and goes to the upper pasture. It comes dark, and they ain't in, so I starts out to meet them. About a half mile from the ranch, I meets them. They're riding the mules, and ain't got much to say. We gets to the ranch, and the missus and the cook comes out when they hears the dogs, and F is hobbling along behind. The boss, he seems to have trouble getting down, and Zeb goes to help him, and pop, something hits, and Zeb sets down and grabs his leg. The boss don't have no more trouble getting off, for the mule bucks him off right now. We get Zeb into the bunkhouse and starts to take off his boots. The boss seems to be sort of awkward. Take both hands, says the missus. I can't, he says. Must have sprained my wrist when that mule bucked me off. We find Zeb's leg ain't broke, but it sure is bruised up a-plenty. We all manages to get to supper, and the boss tells us how it happened. He says, We found a bad place in the fence, and it kept us later'n we figured. We was cutting across to the road, and the mules kept spooking at shatters on the ground. Well, they come to a place and stopped, and I give 'em a lick with the whip. It wasn't no shatter at all. It was a little arroyer. Mules jumped it, but naturally, the spring wagon didn't. It throwed us out over the dashboard, and the double trees busted. There wasn't no stay straps on, and they took out and left us. They took out the way we come. Sure enough, we found them at the gate and rid them home. I felt a leetle lame in the shoulder from diving over that there dashboard. I'm trying to get down slow-like when Zeb comes to help. That's when the dern mule kicks Zeb in the leg and bucks me off. The missus, She pats him on the head, but she says right wicked-like, "Don't you go and worry, dear. Everything is a-going to be all right." Good company for dinner next day, Lem Sykes and the sheriff. They was in a two-seated buckboard, had two fellers with them with handcuffs on. They was the fellers that had traded Lem the mules. Follerin' in a wagon was two big Missourians that the mules had been stole from, and they was there to prove their property, which they sure done.
"Did you cash that check?"
the boss's wife asks Lem. "Yeah," he says, "and I used the money to pay off some debts in town that had been pressing me for quite a spell." Instead of getting mad, she got tickleder than ever. After dinner, the sheriff and Lem goes to get the mules. The sheriff goes in first and gets crowded again the stall. Lem yells and jobs the mule with a pitchfork. The mule kicks and hits the fork and hits Lem in the mouth with the handle, cuts his lip plumb through, knocks two front teeth out. Then, when we looks things over, the sheriff has some ribs broke. The Missourians get the mules tied to the back of their wagon. One of them is to drive the sheriff's team, and Lem rides in the wagon. The sheriff looks at me and says, "Shorty, seeing you're the only able-bodied male citizen thereabouts, I deputize you to buckle on your hog leg and ride herd on this bunch as fur as town." I saddles up and strops on my old six-shooter. As we was starting, the boss, he growls and cusses about having to lose more time appearing in court again them mule thieves. But his wife, she puts her arm around him and says,
"Now don't you go and worry, dear. Everything is going to be all right."
Now we're going to read a poem entitled Thinkin'. It's an easy job, herdin' parada. Your old horse is standin' close by. You're watching the drift of the shadders that's made by the clouds in the sky. There's a breeze blowin' over the mesa. It pulls at the brim of your hat. You feel sorter careless and lazy, but it sets you to thinkin' at that. Of the towns where the folks herd together, with sidewalks and plenty of light. They're sheltered and out of the weather. They sleep in a house every night. There's plenty of good drinking water and places to eat night and day. They live like a man really orter. You wish you was a-living that way. You know lots of outfits and bosses, but this just a cowpuncher's chance. You begin when you're young wrangling hosses and wind up a cook at some ranch. You figure it's really a pity? You've been on the range since a kid. You'd sure like to go to the city, but what could you do if you did? Your IDs get twisted and broken. You reach for your papers and sack. You reckon you'll do some more smoking. You turn with the wind to your back. How things will work out, there's no knowing, but the cattle are starting to stray. So you better get up and be going, for thinking don't help anyway. Now we'll move into Chapter 7, Shorty Goes Home. And there's an author's note. In November of 1936, after Roosevelt's defeat of Landon in the presidential election, Kiskaden probably visited his old home area around Trinidad, Colorado, with the following two thinly veiled autobiographical accounts being the results. The first story is entitled, Shorty Goes Home for Armistice Day. Not long after the boss bought the mules, I gets a chance to go up north. Then along comes that Boer War, and we was all trying to break and sell all the willer tail horses in the western states to the British government. After that, I got a chance to go to Australia. I didn't like it so good as the old USA, so I comes back. I drifts into Arizona for a spell, and then by a fluke, I got back east. By that time, the war is on. I lies 5 years about my age and enlists. When I gets back home, I lands a job in town. So I ain't never seen the old ranch, the boss, nor Bill since 37 years ago. On the way back to my apartment, I sees a gasoline ad with the picture of a cowboy on it, and when I turns, I looks in at a show window that has a mirror in it. It makes me jump. Would anybody ever think that the little gray-headed man with specs on had ever been a cowhand? Hardly. The next morning I goes to work, and there's pictures of Roosevelt and Landon everywhere, just like Bryan and McKinley used to be. That settles it. I went to the manager, told him that I wanted 6 weeks off, starting election day. He looks at me and he says, "You've been with us about 12 years, and it's telling on you." "Yes, but be sure to be back when the time is up. Where will you go?" I tells him, "That's right. You go out there and get some of that western air," he says. Well, I votes, and then I starts out. Meets a lot of friendly folks along the way, and it's a nice trip, where I take my time and visit as I go, because I got a lot of time to make it out home by Armistice Day, and that's when I aim to get there. When I get out to the old short grass country, I remember what the boys said about plowing it up, and they was about right. It sure made me feel bad. One thing I could see, and that was that the old days was over, and no mistake. I stops at an auto camp just outside the old town the night before Armistice Day, for I aim to go in the next day. In the morning, I drives in. There's a garage there, where the old livery stable used to be, so I parks in there and goes out and takes a look around the old county seat. Things has changed a lot. No kids riding burros on the street. No hosses tied around. Just cars. There's a sort of department store built where the old saloon used to stand. There's a moving picture show in the Opry House, where Bill fought the masked marble. And there's a new depot, too. The old jail and courthouse is like they always was. Nobody gives me a second look, for strangers is a plenty. Lots of highway travel. I goes into a bar room, takes a beer to sort of clear my throat. Then I ask him if he knows a feller by the name of Bill Bascom. "Sure, him and F. Lathrop is up at the jail now," he says. That was enough. I goes right up to the sheriff's office. There's a right pretty young lady there at the desk. "Is F. Lathrop and Bill Bascom here?" I asks. She says they are. "What's the charges? What's the chance of getting them out?" I wants to know. She smiles, and a sassy dimple comes in her cheek, and she says, "Well, there ain't much chance. Mr. Bascom has just been elected sheriff for his third term, and as long as he is in office, Mr. Lathrop will be his chief deputy." That sure knocks the props out from under me. She presses a button, and in comes a big fat feller that could just about ride in a wagon box, let alone atop a bronc. I looks at him careful, and then I know it is Bill. He looks friendly, but careful-like at me, and then he asks, "What can I do for you?" Right dignified. "Well," I says, "I'd be right pleased if you'd put on that there dance like you done in the pasture with the willer brushes, accompanied by the two dogs. It'd sure show off that girlish figure of yourn." He looks at me a minute, and then he says, "Well, there ain't no more terbacker engines for you to tie crazy colts to, and if you rode a half-broke hoss into town, I'll throw you in right now. But from the looks of things, you'd do about as well on a bronc as I would on a dance." Then he hollers, "Oh, F!" F knows me right now, and he wants to know where I've been, how come I got back after all these years. So I tell him that I allowed to come back, spend Armistice Day with him or Bill or whoever I could find, the old gang. I told Bill I knowed he would be in it, seeing he was in the old Spanish War. "Yes," says Bill, "I was in it, but this time I got in with the engineer outfit. We was away down in South France. We was logging out turpentine pine to use for timber and corduroy roads. We had an ornery little drunken cuss along that sure put me in mind of you. He'd been a cowpuncher in civil life. That is, if he ever was civil. Well, the stable sergeant is from Montana, And he gets this here little varmint to day herd all the convalescent stock out on the forest reserve while the grass is high. He did so well that he makes a night hawk out of him, puts work stock and all out at nights. Well, one night this here little devil is confined to quarters for some cussedness or another, and it sends a couple other men out with the stock. The night come a storm and scattered the herd. We ain't got the half of them by noon next day. The top cutter knows I've been a cowhand, so he gets the little cuss out of quarters, tells us to saddle up, get them hosses. This wrangler goes to the boys and finds where they had a bunch when the storm hits. He saddles up a big, awkward-looking bay, and we starts off. I'd heard he knowed hosses, but it looked like he sure had picked a poor mount. We got to where the herd had been, looks around at the ground, grass, and the ferns. He grinned and said, "Luck is sure with us." We hadn't gone far when that crazy hoss of his began to snuff, nicker, go toward a bunch of timber. Sure enough, there was some of the strays. He started me along the track of the storm, and he trotted back and forth like a bird dog. Pretty soon, I hears that hoss again, and we gets another bunch. As soon as he throws them to me, he starts off on a long trot, setting loose and easy over his long stirrups. We eat supper on time, and has all the work stock, besides some frog stock that we had to cut back. "That little drinking cuss is a wonder," says the captain. "Well," I says, "he knows hosses. He knows they don't drift again a storm. That big pudding-footed hoss he rode was a hoss fool, and will run squalling and nickering to any hosses he can find. The wind had turned and was blowing right back from where it blowed during the storm. It was made for him and the hoss he was a-riding." The captain looks at me and says real polite-like, "I suppose the wind and weather was different for the other man. Anyhow, he got the stock." That made me mad, but what can you do in the army? "That's right," I says. "What do you know about it?" Bill asks. "Well," I says, "I was there. I lied 5 years about my age, and I got in with no previous service. Besides, they wasn't so particular about the weight and height as they was in the Spanish War." "Yes, sir. But the funniest thing happened to me was the time I got the shoes." "What shoes?" F asks. "Well," I says, "you see, it was like this. We'd got outfitted with a bunch of salvage stuff. There wasn't a pair of shoes in the whole issue that was smaller than a 7, and you know I wear a 5. I put in an extra pair of salvage socks to sort of fill them out, got by the best I could. Well, one day I gets a pass, hikes down to the little village near camp, starts to take on a little of the old Vin Blink. At the same table is setting an awful neat-looking soldier, and I knows on sight he's a dog robber. He's drunk enough to talk, and little feller tells me that he's the colonel's orderly. We get up for a couple more bottles when the old demi-leader is run dry, and I see that he has on a new pair of russet leather shoes, and they are number 5s. Right then I gets an idea. He's got a good start, and I figure that few fellers my size can give me a start and drink me down. Besides, he's about 15 years less experienced in the ways of the wicked world. I'm still going good when he begins to fade out. I gets him out the back door, sets him up again the wheel of an old cart in the shed, takes his shoes off. I tries them on, and they fit perfect. Well, I swaps with him, puts mine on him, sticks the extra socks in his belt so he can do as he likes about using him. That there is about the most terrible deed I've done in France. Bill and F, they gets tickled, and worse tickled than what I expected. We gets out the bottle and has a drink, and then Bill leaves F in the office, takes me out to scare up some old friends. The first place we stop is a shoe store. "Do you know who this here runt is?" Bill asks of the feller that runs the store. The little cuss looks me over right careful, and I do him, and then I know who he is. "If he wasn't so gray and wore specs," says the storekeeper, I'd swear that he was the darn mule Skinner I told you about that stole my shoes in France. Well, son, I says, I'm him, and I went gray-headed, just a-worryin' over that there crime. But seeing you got a whole house full of shoes now, I reckon you ain't a-sufferin' none. He laughs, reckons I must have got his mind started on the shoe business. He calls to his clerk that he's going to be out for a little bit and watch the store. We'll take him over to your aunt's and show her this here little villain that stole your shoes on a cold stormy day in a fern land, says Bill. Now we will read, Shorty finishes his visit. We knocked around that day, and I did get track of a few old-timers, but every time I asked about somebody, Bill or F would say, let me see, he died just after we got the ditch changed, or after we got the road built. He got under my hide so bad that after a while, I was scared to ask any more. But there was one old lady I sure run afoul of, and that was old man Wilson's granddaughter. Bill took me out to where she was a-runnin' a hot dog stand at the edge of town on the highway. Do you recollect this here feller? Bill asks. She looks at me a minute, and then she says, sure I know the scamp. It was enough that he throwed walnuts on the dance hall steps, made my uncle bust his tailbone so it bothered him all the rest of his life. But he has to go and steal the shoes right off of my nephew's feet when he's in a furrin land a-fightin' for his country. Oh, yes, I says. I can mind when you let two fellers fight over a dance with you till they wrecked the place and broke up the dance. And I mind when the other gals was so jealous that they wouldn't speak to you, that you went and halfway promised to marry three single fellers at one party just to make 'em bust up with their gals. You wasn't no dove apiece yourself. She makes out like I made her mad, but she was tickled pink. Made us stay, have a hot dog, cup of coffee. She got a big kick out of telling us all about the different fellers she had kept company with. She'd been a pretty gal, with a dimple in her chin, but now she had three chins, and the dimples seemed to sorter got discouraged and quit altogether. That's all the time we have to read from Shorty's Yarns, Western Stories and Poems of Bruce Kiskaden. Thank you for joining us for Western Short Stories. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or any other smart home device. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.